Talk Show.
Recorded live.
And this is Breckenridge Elkins, once again on American Onslaught Radio, Gangster Bullshit. Tonight, we're going to be talking about some interesting topics that have occurred to me over the past 3 minutes. And this past week, I've been reading James LaFon's site quite a bit. And if you're not familiar with James LaFon, I recommend that you either check out my wall on Facebook, or you go to his website, which is jameslafon.com, I assume. Yes, good Lord, it is. jameslafon.com. Now, who is James LaFon? James LaFon, according to his biography, is a full-time writer, part-time coach, and part-time wage slave with an extensive history of brain trauma. He's been involved in sanctioned and unsanctioned boxing since 1976 and has fought over 600 six fights and more than 200 machete duels, and is still able to tie his shoes. He's written over 140 articles and 10 books. Now, that sounds like basically I'm introducing him. He is not, in fact, going to be on our show tonight, American Onslaught Radio, but we are going to be talking about self-defense. And that's a interesting topic in itself. And we don't believe in self-defense, basically. We believe in self-offense. And the offensiveness prevents defense. I always remember the Viking martial artist, Sven, or whatever his name was, used to say, his father used to tell him, self-defense is what you do just before you die. And there's a certain logic to that, because if you're in a position where self-defense is necessary, you're in trouble.
Yo.
Hey, Kane, how you doing?
Well, pretty good. You've already started the recording, I can hear.
I have. Yep. For some reason, I scheduled the broadcast for 9 Eastern. And
that's
I missed my call. And although it's not 9 Eastern yet, it's apparently, I don't know who guest 2 is, but it started 15 minutes early, despite the fact that I scheduled it for 9 Eastern time, which is 8 my time and American time. In any case, I'm talking a little bit about James LaFond, Daryl. He's on the, he's a writer, and I quite enjoy him as a writer, and he's also a boxer, stick fighter, and he has a very interesting take. Yeah, I would call him an old school gangster Bolshevist, because of his interesting take on society today, and living on the streets of Baltimore, Maryland. And he's also a horror writer and a science fiction writer. And a really cool guy, really. I was reading his biography. He's been a boxer since 1976 and taken part in over 600 stick fights and 200 machete duels, and is still able to tie his shoes. Now, I have never fought a machete duel. I used to fight with sticks all the time, big sticks, little sticks. We used to do bouts by the number of cuts one would sustain, and essentially, with the old sticks, what we do is cut off a hand grip. But once, you know, the hand grip was all smoothed out and everything, we'd fight each other till, you know, you try to reach for your opponent's hands and try to stick them with your stick, with the sharp end. And then you'd, if you get them to cut, get their hand cut, they're blood flowing in the hand would eventually make their stick hard to hold because it was smooth on one end. We'd whittle it down or grind it down with a table grinder. Mm-hmm. where it was nice and smooth, and so the blood would make your hand slippery on the stick, and usually that's how we judge about. We're just kids fooling around, of course. But I do find stick fighting to be very entrancing, a very interesting topic. And like I said, LaFon's views on Baltimore and the blacks, he's very opposed to white supremacists because they tried to kill him. I don't know if he'd be favorable to coming on as a guest on the evening, but I'm going to invite him. And maybe if we have Robert Lindsay on first, that would help. So I would like to interview Robert Lindsay, but I'm kind of sleep deprived right now. And if we were doing gangster Bolshevik broadcasting, I would make a joke about being on meth, but of course I've never used meth, and so I just haven't been sleeping lately. I can't attribute that to drug use to bait individuals like I used to. So basically, I haven't slept in a while. I don't feel like I'm smart enough to interview Robert Lindsay at this time. I've lost too much of my IQ, and until I can catch up with my brain power, I cannot really interview Robert Lindsay. And hopefully I will resume my approach toward a higher IQ in the next week. I did get out and run 3 miles today with my dogs, and that was very positive gesture. I enjoyed that quite a bit. I was a little worried about losing some wind, but I pretty much maintained my wind despite the fact that I hadn't been able to run much in the last couple of weeks due to busyness around the place. I'd like to talking before you got on, Kane. I would rather talk about offense than defense when it comes to self-defense. And James LaFon's made a very interesting point, and I'm going to shut up in a minute and let you talk, but he made a very interesting point in one of his recent notes on his blog, and that's American violence has always been prejudiced against the individual, the violent individual, the serial killer, that type of person. We glorify group violence. We if 3 or 4 guys beat up a guy or, you know, whatever, it's not as bad. Or if police do it, or if a group of people do it, it's not as bad in American sight. If an army does it, but if a serial killer does it, Americans have a problem with it. And I think that's somewhat correct, because I don't think serial killing is really stigmatized as much in other parts of the world. Yes, we think of it as being stigmatized in Japan and in Europe, but we're viewing the situation from an American lens. So what information we have about war and serial killers is often we're seeing those foreign serial killers through an American lens rather than a lens projecting, you know, their own country's vision of them. So I think that's kind of, I was reading about this serial killer down in South America who's responsible for over 150 deaths. And I just think that their feeling toward him would be different than American feeling toward him. And so what's your reaction to that, Daryl?
Well, first of all, you know what Richard DeMere said, that serial killers do on a level with her. So, secondly, if you look at like somebody like Pedro Lopez, he has probably the highest kill count.
Kane, I can barely hear you.
Okay,
there you go.
Lopez? Okay, he has probably the highest kill count known, and he would just get little short-term arrests, and then they'd let him go again, like he was in the Andes. So, yeah, I guess in certain parts of the world, people don't punish it as much as we do.
Well, I just think their attitude is different, because we have always glorified group violence, not individual violence. And I thought that was a hugely valid point LaFon's point of view, and a very, very astute observation. And so for the individual, there's a situation where we think about things, but we don't really internalize the reason for them being that way. And it's the same with what LaFon's saying. Basically, he has to go to work on the streets, and he's more afraid of the cops than he is of any potential muggers or anything like that on the bus or weird people, you know. I'm not sure why guests 3 and 4 have left the chat room. I'm deeply disturbed by this. I'm not sure what they expected. I'm going to step out. Who is guest 2? I have no idea. Anyway, moving on here. Can you hear me okay, Kane?
I got used to it. At first it was very loud, like not very loud, but I got used to it.
Okay, let me see. Can you hear me better now?
A little bit.
Ah, hell. I was trying out I'm sorry?
What were you just saying before that? Because I had to talk before you were asking if I heard you.
Yeah, go ahead.
But what were you talking about? I kind of lost the thought. What were you talking about?
I can barely hear you, Kane. You have to speak up.
Okay, what were you just talking about before you...
I was talking about group violence versus individual violence, and I was talking about LaFond speaking about how he was more afraid of the cops arresting him for defending himself.
I remember, Richard, you were saying before that it's important to take a true antagonistic view towards the cops and not view them as your friends. Like, you were really stressing that in the past.
Are you walking, Kane? Because I can really barely hear you. You're breaking up on me.
I'm not walking. My phone must suck. But I'm sure. My guess is that everybody else can hear me fine.
I'm sorry.
I'm not. My phone must suck. But I'm speaking up. So.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure where you were when what you said last, but. And like I said, I'm a bit worse than for the wear, so I can't remember what I said 3 minutes ago or whenever it was. If you type it into the chat, I might be better able to remember whatever it was you're trying to refresh my mind, because you're breaking up on me.
I'm on my computer now, so I can't type.
Okay. Well, go ahead and refresh my memory then. I can hear you a little better now.
Basically, I was just reminding you that in the past, you were very much stressing the point that cops should not be viewed as your friends. Like, you stressed that in the past.
Oh, yes, I see your point. Yes, absolutely. I'd have to agree with that 100%. But anyway, things have very drastically changed. And like I said, I thought I would talk a little bit about the subject tonight. And can you hear me better now, Kane?
A little bit. I'm just getting used to it. I'm good.
Okay. Well, here we go. I was trying out a new system there. But anyway, I'm hoping Michael and what's his name will call in, because actually, I'd like to talk about riding trains very shortly, and I'd like to interview trains, because that's something I'd like to do, but I'm not driving all the way to Philly to do it. I guess I could hop a train to Philly and hook up with the guys, but then I'm not really one to attend an AMRIN conference. Nothing personal, but it's a white thing, you know? So, go ahead. One more time.
So my feelings towards that those group of people, don't offend me at all.
Well, I don't expect any racial antagonism. I'm just saying it's not my thing, you know. I don't know if I could ride a train all the way to Philly. It would be pretty tough to hop a train for Philly, but it's something I would like to do. It's just something I haven't done yet. I had picked up a gutter punk a while back, and we talked quite a bit about train hopping and such things, and so I'm very into it. I'd really like to try hopping a train
near where I'm at, there's a spur where they recouple cars. They'll park some cars temporarily, and then they'll leave them there overnight and come for them and put them back on the main track. And I've always thought about, I've thought about spray painting 819 on the side of the boxcars, and then I thought about stowing away on the boxcar and seeing wherever the train went. And I watched a Vice documentary about train riding that was very instructive. But anyway, getting off topic here, I want to talk a bit about self-defense. And if Pastor Lindstedt were with us tonight, which he's not, he would undoubtedly tell us a story about how he got his SKS back in the early 90s when things were going for $50 to $75 a piece, and he's got a shotgun and a 38 pistol, and that's all you need for self-defense. And I'm not disagreeing with that, but there's some people who really dislike guns. LaFond is like that. He claims he can't shoot, but I think anybody can shoot with a few minutes of practice. It's, you know, any clear-headed individual can do that. But in any case, LaFond is more focused on martial arts, though he's pretty skeptical of a lot of martial arts and mixed martial arts fighters and fighting because of the situation. A lot of those sports are not full contact, and a lot of the dojos are just frauds in many ways, and it's not a win-win situation to attend them, because you're losing money and you're losing time, and you still stand the chance of getting hurt. And so it's a interesting matter, certainly, to observe self-defense, the nature of self-defense. Was Jacob planning to be on tonight, Kane?
I have not seen him active at all today, so I don't have any expectations.
We're going to have to get you a microphone if you go walking around, and you can see, it's easier for you on this show, you can tell people you're live on the radio now. If you get a little microphone and just walk up to random people, and you just have to tell them you're live on a radio, and I'll interact with them. And I'll tell them they won the sweepstakes or something. And then I'll ask them their opinion on whether they think they could juggle knives, steak knives. Hey, you win a free set of steak knives if you can juggle them. Something like that. So that's something we can think about down the road. But as far as mixed martial arts go, I basically had two experience with two coaches. One is more boxing oriented. He diversified because basically no one boxing just isn't very sexy anymore. But I think boxing is just as effective as any other sport. And what has always struck me when I go into some of these gyms is that there are no white guys in there, or there'll be a couple of big, heavy-set white guys, and everybody else is a Mexican or some sort of Asian, and we don't have any blacks around here, so it's basically Mexican or Asian, but, you know, it's a very few blacks or whites. It's kind of one of the odd situations, and in any case, I think gyms are good recruiting locations because, it's like Mishima said, whatever you do, you have to have a rigorous ideology and a taste for violence. And, you know, it's something a lot of people who have different ideas about the world have in common or can find in common. When you're looking for things to have in common, you look for common enemies, you look for common points in your natural way of thinking. In other words, we're thinking about basics here, and it's very easy for somebody to talk about something that doesn't matter to them or something they have no control over. When we talk about basic existence, then when we come down to the way we live our lives, we find out that, hey,
People on opposing sides often live their lives exactly the same way, so why should they be in opposition to one another? So a rigorous ideology and a taste for violence is my personal litmus test, and that's where I would expect to find individuals who are like-minded. And so if they're not gangster Bolsheviks yet, they could be. And that's why I pretty much see that. LaFont's basically written the book on a lot of different aspects of this because he's interviewed a lot of people. I don't know a lot of, I don't have a lot of knowledge about the subject. Mike Brown wrote a book about his experiences in prison called Iron, Bloody Iron, which is a very interesting book, because a history of violence. Prison's Bloody Iron, that's what it's called, not Iron Bloody Iron. If I ever want to write a book, I can call it Iron Bloody Iron, because it's unique in that respect. But Prison's Bloody Iron, it's a interesting book. It talks about how when they were kids, they would make in juvenile detention facilities, they would make knives out of, what is that thing you use to trim your toenails? Toenail clippers, obviously. And they'd file these down, and they couldn't do a lot of damage to each other with them, but they could get very good at fighting each other. And this is basically what we used to do as a kid, is that we would just try to be able to stick the opposition, and whoever, you know, got cut the most lost, and that was how we judged that kind of thing, rather than some other means. But it was a very difficult situation to master, and certainly a very difficult situation because you're always cutting up your hands. When you're a 10-year-old, that's not necessarily fun. Also, we used to go by bruises when it came to staff fighting. And a friend of mine has carried a sword cane for years, but he also carries a gun. And I'm not really big on sword canes. It's a very interesting aspect of defense. I suppose the best defense is the cane defense, which is to run. Not everybody can run, but I figure anybody who doesn't have to, who is too slow to run is probably big enough to withstand a major attack, and still survive it, if not actually walk away from it. And so what is the art of simple offense is partially never to act alone, because basically if you notice serial killers throughout the history of serial killing, they've never been one to have problems with the people who dwell on their streets. For example, Richard Ramirez was not bothered, even though he lived in bad areas. Serial killers can live in bad areas without being viewed as prey by other predators. That's what I'm saying. It's like tigers and, you know.
There's people like Ted Bundy who travel around the country. There are people like Dennis Rader who appear to his family. And they, whatever environment they're in, they blend in.
Yeah, that's it's very congruent that way because it saves a lot of time essentially. And the point I'm trying to make is that people with a serial killer mentality are not victims. And not everybody can cultivate a serial killer mentality, but it is an interesting section of thought. For example, people who I would, you know, almost certainly say that people who listen to Zeke are less likely to get mugged than people who listen to Lady Gaga. And same with, I don't know, you have to determine with the Korn fans and the Slipknot fans. I always say strangle on Slipknot and choke on Korn. But I don't really care for any of these bands, because bands usually come in two varieties, and Zeke is the welcome intermediary between, but even so, Zeke represents a really rock and roll aggressive type, and if you look at their supporters, they're the type of tattooed, muscled people who just don't get, just not victim mentality. Some people, it's like the guy says in The Magnificent Seven, if they're not sheep, how did he put it, if God did not make them to be sheared, he would not have made them sheep or something like that. So the mentality is quite unique. And while I don't think a open hunting season is necessarily approved, I do believe the advantages of creating an exterior situation to benefit everyone is a huge advantage. And, for example, having a situation in which people's life, or property, not life, is in danger, everybody is pretty much urged to let their property go. And if your property was not insured, then it's not really a big deal. In other words, you lose. If you didn't insure your property and you lose it, hey, what are you going to do about it? Tough luck, you know? I'm sorry?
Really have a view on property owners.
Kane, the other listeners are telling me I hear, they can hear me pretty well, so I'm not sure your cell phone is.
So, you hear me? Can you hear me?
Anyway, maybe he's hunting up somebody to talk to. The situation is, could we potentially seek an outlet to the insurance fraud situation? Because, like, a guy I know had his trailer broken into and stole $5,500. $5,500 in
would be no insurance companies at all. But I don't know about an outlet in the real world.
I'm sorry?
That in my ideal world, there would be no insurance companies at all.
Obviously, if insurance is largely parasitism, and like I said, with this guy, he had $5,500 of stuff stolen out of his trailer, and he never got a dime of it back, plus he lost what was in there. So the situation is not ideal, but in any case, the point is that if that guy had been mugged of the same amount of money or on the street, he still wouldn't have gotten his money back. And so it would not have been, it was not opportune either way, no matter how you spin it, it's not happening. So the point is that what happened to guests 2, 3, and 4? We're in a situation where I don't know how many slashes I've made and I don't see any activity by guests 2, 3, and 4. This is unacceptable. This is completely unacceptable. I'm demanding the return of guests 2, 3, and 4. Kane, we're going to really have to work on increasing the number for this new call. This is a new call, the American Onslaught broadcast. And consequently, we are dealing with the kinks of having an even more limited audience. Now, Kane, I noticed the Fora is completely down. Did you pull it completely, or is it going to be coming back up?
I'm not sure what you're talking about.
The Fora.co.
It's a mockery forum that's making fun of another forum through any new...
It's down?
It was down earlier, but I didn't do anything. I put
on
the fire, and then I paid again. So
I was just wondering if it was if you'd taken it down.
I didn't not in the last hour.
Okay. I see it's up it's back up now. Yeah. So anyway, the point is that insurance is another issue that people don't contemplate when it comes to self offense. And there's two ways of looking at that because, like I was telling somebody the other day, when it comes to planting my corn this spring, I'm kind of shorthanded. And I would like to plant more corn, but I don't have the necessary help. And so the ideal solution is to go on a raiding party, get some people together, get on horses, and raid some villages within a 100-mile radius and take some slaves to work in the fields for me. We plant the corn, water the corn, weed the corn, fertilize the corn, spray the corn, get all that done. The whole point is that I don't have the option of taking that offensive action. And on the other hand, I can't take defensive action either. Otherwise, I lose insurance. Or the insurance makes it very difficult if I'm simply acting in defense of my property. Whereas if you have enough property, you don't have to defend it. Because, that's just the way it works. The more property you have, the less necessity you have to personally defend it. But on the other hand, there's been a lot of Hollywood movies made about self-defense and about the castle doctrine, about the embattled family man taking up a gun or some sort of weapon to defend his family or his house or something or other. And the whole point of that is that, you know, the thing is they push him and they bully him until he's at the end of his rope and he doesn't have a choice but to fight back. And this is the opposite. That is self-defense. Self-defense is not.
Columbine is self-defense because, unlike some other shooting stuff, the people at Columbine specifically overwhelm.
Well, yeah, but my point is that self-offense is a far more practicable solution. So I highly recommend that better. And it's some, but it saves a lot of work. Like I said, instead of having to worry about defending yourself, you worry about trying to take stuff from other people. But see, basically, what it's self-offense that is illegal in this country, in essence. And so that's kind of interesting to notice, to note. But I'm going to talk about methods of self-defense, and I read a guy a while back, the most effective weapon he'd ever seen used was a rice flail, and what I would do is, anybody else online?
I just joined in. This is Mike.
How you doing, Mike?
Hey, man. It's Paul.
I'm sorry?
This is Paul?
Yeah.
Hey, nice to meet you, man. 819.
Same here. Same. 819, brother. We're talking a little bit about methods and philosophies of self-defense tonight, and what I was talking about earlier was a guy named James LaFond. His website, he's a writer and a martial arts trainer, and he was pointing out the difference that in America, group violence is glorified, whereas individual violence, such as that inflicted by the serial killer, is criticized and feared and disliked.
Oh, yeah.
But
I definitely see that, yeah. I mean, to kind of chime in for just a second on that topic, I would say that's kind of a symptom of just the general kind of Western fear or American fear of individualism, you know, because everything is pretty much collectivized, and collectivism is pretty much the mantra of American society. So I think as long as it's a collective kind of act, then it's definitely going to be a lot more glorified than the individual act, which is always going to be demonized, I think, you know.
Well, we talk about American being a individual society, and we are a very conformist society in most ways.
Right.
I think everybody wants their own share of the loot, but there's enough loot to go around, so everybody's fat and happy, and it's not like we're all fighting over something for our own situations. Yes, we're very atomized, but I wouldn't necessarily say we're individualized, because obviously there's three steps of personalization, individualization, and atomization. And atomization, of course, refers to objects that are less than sentient. So we're dealing with material. You could say individuals are humans, whereas atoms are, you know, less than human. So that's the way I see it anyway. But we're talking a little bit about self-defense. And I was also telling Kane that I found train riding fascinating. And we're definitely going to have to do a whole show and devote it to that.
Oh, yeah.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, yeah, I was just saying, you know, that'd be great. That's a great idea, you know. Like I said on the thread in Facebook, you know, me and Harlem are actually planning on going freight hopping next month to the Ameren conference. So I'm definitely looking forward to that. It'll be my first time, whereas for Harlem, I don't know, it's probably his, I'm not sure how many times he's been, going on those sort of trips, but yeah, for me, it's going to be my first time, so I'm definitely really excited.
So where are you guys? Have you met Harlem, or is he in your area?
Oh, no, I haven't met him in, offline in real life yet. We just met each other
through
Facebook. Yeah, in the flesh. Well, he lives in, I think he's in Brooklyn, not in Brooklyn, the Bronx, I think, and I'm in Chicago. We're gonna meet up in Philadelphia, and then head south from there.
He's
gonna show me the ropes.
Is he the guy who did the Vice documentary on train hopping, or was he a part of that Vice documentary?
I have no idea. I don't think so. I wouldn't know about that. He didn't mention anything like that. No.
Well, I was just wondering, because I don't recognize him, but the Vice documentary on train hopping was very interesting, and
I should check that out. I didn't even know they made a documentary on freight hopping. Is it on YouTube? Or?
Yeah, I'll post it in the chat in a second, so our guests
yeah.
can see it. But yeah, it was a really cool documentary. I'm not saying they. You know, it's a Vice documentary, so it is what it is.
But,
you know, I there's been some really cool train hopping activity, like Bob Wayne of the Outlaw Carnies band. He had a criminal record, so they wouldn't let him into Canada. So basically, he got himself smuggled into Canada. He rode a freight car into Canada, and that's how he got into and did a whole tour in Canada. So I thought that was pretty cool, and I'm not really crazy about. I think freight train riding in Canada is more cool, but I love freight train riding movies, and I've never done it myself, but it's definitely something that I want to try. It's one of those situations, as I was telling Kane, is that there's a sidetrack near my house where they leave cars periodically, and I've been meaning to go down there and spray paint 819 on the cars for some time, and that'd be a very convenient place to get on board a freight train, but haven't gotten around to it. Now, in the Vice documentary, they actually were able to get into a locomotive cab and ride that way for a bit, and I don't know how common it is to be able to enter a locomotive cab. One thing that used to quite interest me as a kid was the caboose, because, you know, in every small town in Missouri, you have little caboose on the side of the railroad tracks as a little old-fashioned museum. And so I've always had an interest in trains, so that's very interesting, and I'd definitely like to do a whole show on the subject. But we're talking a little bit about self-offense tonight, and the serial killer is a I was telling Kane earlier that it appears to me that the serial killer is just another predator in the jungle. He is not necessarily a prey to any existing predator in the urban jungle. In other words, all your great serial killers that move through the cities and violent areas without ever falling prey to being robbed or being attacked in any way or something like that. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Sounds pretty pretty accurate, yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of these are not necessarily physically imposing specimens like Richard Ramirez, but they have their own mentality that announces that they're a dangerous person. And so it's kind of interesting because people are always talking about weapons and tactics and various means of self-defense and all that. And by and large, unless it's an emergency, I can't be bothered to carry a weapon, even a knife. It weighs down my pocket. And I have switchblades and all kinds of neat knives, and for the most part, I don't carry them unless I need to cut some fruit. How do you feel about knives and concealed carry of weapons?
I think it's definitely necessary. I mean, it depends obviously on the situation you're in or whatever, you know, where you live and your surroundings. But, I mean, this is actually kind of interesting that we're on this topic because I think it also kind of, you know, fits pretty well into the topic of freight train riding and you know, kind of tramping around across the country, because me and Harlem actually talked about this when we were going over our, you know, how to prepare for the trip. And, you know, it would be wise to carry a blade with you, a knife, when you're going cross country, because, you know, I mean, you just never know. And, you have to keep your options open in that way, you know, in case you do come across a mugger or, you know, some kind of something like that, some kind of situation like that where you have to defend yourself, you know.
Well, the situation I came up with, and I'll let you talk in a minute, Kane, is that I think the biggest problem you will face is from the cops. And that's what it appears. Now, these guys in the Vice documentary, they're riding trains in the western United States. And, you know, they're leaving from Los Angeles to go to the Hobo Convention in Iowa in the documentary. And so they don't face too much of that problem. And, yes, I imagine in some instances you have situations where you have to defend yourself. But, honestly, unless you're in a really bad, heavily populated gang territory, it seems to me that, yes, a knife. I would definitely carry a knife if I were, you know, traveling long distance, even in a car or whatever, but something like that. It's just not something I do every day. But it seems to me that the cops would be your number one priority. And then again, if they do pull you over, And you never know with cops these days. You might lose the knife anyway. They might steal it, or they might say it was over the one inch law or whatever, and or if it wasn't legal in that state. So there's a lot of factors to consider, of course, with carrying a knife. I'm not. What I was actually saying earlier on in the show is I was talking about James LaFon's blog, jameslafon.com, and he was talking about he lives in Baltimore, and he's basically a old-school gangster Bolshevik, but his main concern is he may be able to fight off muggers or whatever, but the problem is always going to be the cops showing up, because the cops are always the principal, your principal problem. They are the largest gang that you have to deal with in the world, so that's my concern with traveling, because yes, I have had to deal with cops quite a bit, not hugely. I've never been arrested or anything like that, but I've had to been stopped and had to deal with cops, and had to deal with cops when I had weapons on me that I found out were illegal to carry without a permit, or just plain illegal, like switchblades. And I just mentioned that because, like I said, that would be the biggest problem I would have with train riding is cops. Mm. So
I agree. I mean, that's the number one threat. But, yeah, I mean, I just meant kind of like a just-in-case situation.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. I wouldn't dream of doing that without taking a knife. It's good for so many other uses, but so, it's kind of different from the old school railroad bull, train yard bull, because it's different from assaulting one of them to assaulting an officer. I mean, there's a huge gap between the two, and so that's another problem, with doing something like that. I'm very fortunate in my county. Assault is very rarely a criminal offense, because in most cases the officers just let it go, and I mean it's pretty I like to put it this way: we have liberal assault laws, because if people get into a fist fight, two guys get into a fist fight and the cops are called, the cops will probably not arrest them, and they have a crowded jail as it is, and one thing and another. Whereas I think in most big cities, if people get in a fist fight in a bar, they're going to spend the night in jail probably. Mm-hmm. And so it's just the mentality varies, and I've never had a altercation, but from what I've observed of cops and listen to on their radio bands and all, that's what my general feeling is. But, of course, I'm in a very small region of Missouri, a rural region is what I was going for, rural region of Missouri that is kind of quite liberal as far as self-defense goes. We very open-minded. Progressive when we come with ideas of self-defense, which is a good thing, obviously. What's it like in your neck of the woods, Michael, in the Chicago area?
Oh, in Chicago, the cops are just terrible, man. They'll arrest you for pretty much anything, I mean, this is police state, as bad as it gets, really, I mean, I can't really imagine cops going easy on you for any reason in Chicago. I mean, I've gotten into some trouble with the law myself. I've been arrested a couple times, but I mean, granted, it wasn't really for small. I mean, it wasn't really. I wasn't really in the right. I mean, I guess I'd be arrested for what I. One of them was criminal trespassing into an elementary school during summer break. So I think you'd pretty much be arrested for that anywhere, but. Generally, I mean, even for small stuff, minor offenses, in some cases, not even really offenses, I would think, just for talking back or for kind of, giving the cop staff, or I think I don't know how it is in other cities, but in Chicago, I mean, you can get arrested for videotaping a cop, right?
I've heard that. Now, as I've understood it, there was a Supreme Court ruling on that, or is there a Supreme Court ruling that is imminent on that?
Yeah, I think in Illinois, I don't know if it's the only state in the United. I mean, there's probably some other couple states or something that have it, that have that law, but pretty much, I think it's more or less unique to Chicago as a city where this can happen, you know.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing about it is that, you know, that whole phenomenon is, of course, I think it's happened in Texas as well. They've tasered people for videotaping and all that as well, but What is the crime right there? Do you feel? I honestly don't really feel threatened too much by local criminals. But that could be because the cops crack down on them quite a bit and leave the citizens alone. Is that the case in Chicago? Do you feel threatened by?
You know, it really does depend on the neighborhood. You know, you go down south side of Chicago or. Southwest side, places like Englewood pretty much anywhere south or even kind of the west side, southwest side, you know, it can get pretty bad from what I've heard. I personally don't spend a lot of time in those areas. I have no reason to go there. So I personally don't really know if it's, you know, if it's as bad as they say it is on TV and whatnot, but from what I've heard, I mean, you know, it does get pretty bad. You know, people, innocent people get shot for no reason, you know, things like that. So, yeah, you know, I heard it can get pretty bad in certain areas. You know, as far as the cops kind of, you know, the police force being any sort of adequate counter to that, I don't know. I mean, a lot. Yeah, I just think even the police, Chicago police force is corrupt in too many ways, in so many ways that, you know, I think they're in a way kind of letting a lot of these criminals in a way even get away with certain things. If there's a reward for the cop or for the police officer in a certain situation, I don't know personally, but it can get pretty bad in certain parts of Chicago, you know.
Well, as I see it, most people who get killed in the street, it's got to do with a drug deal that something went wrong mostly. And if you're not buying drugs, you're pretty safe. But that's my perspective.
Generally, I would agree with that. But there's also a lot of, you know, even kind of just kind of crossfire incidences where, you know, children and stuff get shot, you know, put in the hospital for, I don't know, maybe, you know, just being in the wrong place at the wrong time sort of thing, you know?
Yeah.
So Mike was talking about the subway when I was with him about how certain subways are okay, but other subways aren't.
Oh, yeah, that's true too, Daryl, yeah. I mean, you know, like the green line, and the red line is the one that goes north and south, and that's the one that's you got to watch out on that one. But the green line is the one that goes to Englewood, which I think the worst, pretty much generally considered the worst neighborhood in Chicago. And, yeah, I mean, you just go on YouTube and, type in, Chicago green line or something, and I'm sure you'll find, you know, a lot of cell phone video footage and stuff just incredibly, violent, loud, aggressive behavior, and it's kind of interesting to watch. So,
well, it's always interesting to watch all those street fights on YouTube, but I don't like to get too close to them. I guess we have Pastor Lindstedt online. Is that you, Pastor?
Yeah, it is. Last night, for some reason, I couldn't get the Fora.co up. You know what I mean?
Neither could I. I was asking Kane about that earlier.
Well, first of all, I didn't deposit funds, but to tell anybody who's listening new, that's just a website that's designed to make fun of other websites. So, but yeah, it should be up now because I deposited funds.
Okay, yeah.
I don't even care enough to pay.
Hey, listen, you guys, I got to get off for a little bit. I'll probably call in a little bit, though. So,
we're not out for much longer.
Okay. Well,
Pastor Lindstedt have his say, and then we're going to close down. But,
right.
I'll listen
to the recording. So, 8:19, guys. Peace out.
You have a good night. I appreciate you calling in.
No problem.
Pastor, we're talking a little bit about big city problems, self-defense in the big city, and crime rates, and also talking about train riding, train hopping, which is a interesting pastime. The whole hobo thing seems to be coming back somewhat, and I picked up a kid the other day going to Kansas City, and he told me he hopped a freight train out of Arkansas, and he was going back to Boulder, and so we had a good talk, but I think...
Colorado?
Yeah, Colorado. And so it's kind of coming back. I know for a long time people hitchhiked riding them big trucks like you used to drive, and now they seem to be going back to...
You couldn't, you know, if you're a company driver, you can't pick up hitchhikers. If you do and they find out about, you know, you'll be fired. Now, some of them do. I mean, they pick up lot lizards and, you know, pretty well take them to a different place here. You know what I mean? They exchange for some benefits. But you are not, you know, when you're driving a big truck, if you're a company driver and they find out about it, you'll be fired because essentially their insurance company, you know, even if they're self-insured here, I mean, essentially, you know, they'll just fire you if they find out about it. You know what I mean? So you don't do it. You know what I mean? Of course, some people do it. Mainly, they pick up lot lizards here, whores, and essentially, you know, I mean, if they find it hard going, you know, they're being cracked down in Texas here, they'll take them across to Alabama or Mississippi or wherever. You know, I mean, they'll just go ahead and move them to a different state or something like that here, even though I guess that's illegal too. But, in any case, so I guess it was fairly interesting. I only caught that at the very last minute when, essentially I got on, I got done my chores for the day and essentially I sat down from my, EIB studio, you know, the Aries Syphilis and Broadcasting, and I sat down and I seen over on the floor dot, you know, over on the shit box in the Fora.co that essentially you were having the one which is mainly your talk show, I think, here, American something or another.
Yeah, and interview and try to be more respect.
Okay. Anyway, let's see. Did Arthur and Virginia Wagner, did they go back to Texas then, or where they were from?
I think separately.
Say again.
Oh, sorry, I'm talking to someone else.
Like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was wondering if they went back to Texas or whatever. I don't know if anybody's paying attention to it now anymore.
I'll be paying attention in about 30 seconds.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah, I'm checking out.
What happened? Oh, you're checking out?
Yeah, I'm checking out of a cashier.
Oh, okay. All right.
Yeah.
This is Beck, right?
Yeah, I'll be ready in just a sec.
Okay, I'm not quite sure.
They should have brought up the FTRA, the Freight Train Riders of America, but I couldn't bring it up during the conversation. Like, I didn't even have a chance to bring it up, but they are a gang that... I'll be ready just a sec.
All right. So, I'll let Brett or Kane, do their transactions here. I'm wondering who's hosting.
Okay, I'm back. I'm back.
Oh, okay.
This is
Brett. All righty. Yeah, did Arthur and Virginia, Wagner, did they head back to Texas then?
Yeah, I believe they left for Texas this weekend. They're going to be closer to their folks down there, help them load up, and they've got taking a horse trailer down there because they got their sheep dogs, and they sold their sheep, but they're keeping their sheep dogs and their cats, so they got a bunch of cats, so they had to take their horse trailer down there and haul the dogs and the cats. And
do they have little cages for their kitty cats, or did they just sort of make them as best they could here?
I don't know. I think they had cages for the cats, and the dogs were kind of just able to roll around.
Okay. Well, hopefully you told them you gave them a greeting from me or something like that.
I did. Arthur remembers you. He said to say hello when I saw you next. And they're getting up there in age. They're in their early 80s or middle 80s anyway. But we're fixing to close down next week.
I wanted to give a big news here. Pretty well it's been the last month or so, but John Britton and myself were on the outs here. Pretty well Monday he called me in and gave me a death threat over the phone here. He's all mad at me here. So pretty well I helped him out here with a lawsuit, and he wanted to settle for amount of money here, and he got twice that much, and he decided to blame me for Brian Rio. And that wasn't the case at all, but he pretty well got twice as much money as what he was willing to settle for, and he went ahead and blew it within 5 months here. And so he decided to go ahead and blame me for it. So, that's just the way it is here. Nothing, I guess nothing really lasts forever now, does it?
Well, I'm sorry to hear about that. Haven't heard from John in a long time, and it's very unfortunate that he can't. He's less than grateful, but he's a very strange guy in some ways.
Well, what really freaked him out is when he's pulling all this crap here on the 5th of January 2014, around 2 hours and 19 minutes, guest number 46 calls in and introduces himself as Cody Britton. John Britton's Cherokee son here, who is also a homosexual. And pretty well John Britton and his nephew were in the chat room, and they sort of freaked out. And essentially, he's not working for a spammer. He's an airline pilot. And pretty well, from what I gather, John Britton had a Basque Mexican girlfriend, when he was in high school, and pretty well, she gave birth to a son, and then later on, I guess he pepped it again, and he has another son who's I don't think he's a homosexual, but he's even worse, he's a lawyer in Alaska, and then there's another woman and another son somewhere in New England, you know what I mean?
That's a lot of sons. That's a lot of sons. I thought he only had daughters.
Well,
and then again, he did email me once and tell me he had three sons. So this is back in 2006 when you were still in the nut house.
He said he had three sons in 2006?
He said three. This was back in 2006 when you were in the nut house. So I don't have that email, but I remember that because later on, he told me he only had six daughters, so I was wondering what happened to the sons.
Six daughters?
Yeah.
He's supposed to only have five daughters.
Well, that's what he told me. I'm just you know, going by what I've heard over the years, from Stumble In, you know, from Speakeasy to Stumble In to Bear Barrel, going down the line, you know, it's been a lot of forums, and I've heard a lot of different things, but he kind of emailed me in a private discussion once and said, I'm trying to raise my my sons to be men or whatever, and like in response to one of my articles, and I was thinking, oh, that's cool, and then I find out he didn't have any sons, according to him, so I don't know, it's I just always remember that from back in 2006.
Well, I'll be damned. I mean, he's been, I don't know, he had a fanciful genealogy, and he believes he's descended from King Saul, but 6 months ago, I was looking around, and I found out that essentially his uncle and his father, you know, the Britons came from northeast Oklahoma. You know what I mean? What was known as the Indian, you know, essentially was known as the Indian Nation. So they come, you know, essentially they're Anglo Mestizo Okies from Muskogee. You know what I mean? I've always thought that your bunch here, essentially, when they're following the Trail of Tears, they decide wherever they're going, they don't want to go where essentially the U.S. government got. So I always thought that your bunch snuck off about 80 miles shy, you know, about 80 some miles shy of the destination here. You know what I mean? One night you were in the Trail of Tears. One night your family was in the Trail of Tears. Next night, they sort of headed on out. Now, I might be wrong, but I've always assumed that of you and your family. You know, is that true or not?
My family is from the northern reservations up in New York, upstate New York, in that area. It's my white side moved over here from California.
Okay, so you're not really a Cherokee or anything like that.
No,
I'm
northern tribes.
Northern tribes, like the, you know, I mean, you know,
Mohawk.
You know, on the border, Mohawk is opposed to Seneca, right? I don't know why they call it Seneca. There's not hardly any Senecas. There's plenty of Eastern Shawnees, and there's some Wyandots, you know, which is around Wyandotte, but I've never really heard of any Seneca Indians in Seneca, Missouri, or Oklahoma, for that matter. You know what I mean?
Well, I don't think there are any, but it's kind of like whites. You can't really find any tribes that are one thing or another. It's like, I mean, you know, you can't find any ethnically normal Norwegians in the U.S. or ethnically normal Irish. You know, you find mixed people, mixed up whites. You have mixed up Indians. There's hardly any. The tribes are all mixed up. I mean, there's not many except on the reservations that aren't mixed up or have some white blood in them or. Or a lot of the creeks there have black bloods. A lot of the creeks look completely black over in Oklahoma, around Grove, I guess, over there in the reservation.
Yeah.
You got a lot of black creeks.
Oh, what happens is that you had this character called Unknown Fucktard, and his name was Dale McCone. And essentially, he looks like Shandy Irish, but from what I gather, he had a nigger Indian girlfriend, and she looked more nigger than anything. And, you know, she was in there for some violence, something little, you know, little bad axe, or, you know, essentially everybody called her little badass, but her name was Little Bad Axe, A-X-E. And she looks more like a nigger than anything. But, no, I've come to a conclusion here. I mean, I've looked at John Britton's. I've gone ahead and relooked, and after I got that, article about where the Britons come from, I mean, I essentially think they're Anglo Mestizos. And I've been asking this old guy, Dewey Tucker. He does not like Richard Butler, and he didn't like Newman Britton. He didn't like a number of people. So I'm getting a pretty bad account from him. But essentially, from my gather, Butler tried to take over Wesley Swift's church. After Swift died, essentially was unsuccessful, so he, essentially, Butler and the Britons moved on to Idaho. And pretty well Wesley Swift's church sort of died out here because, you know, it's just like a lot of things here. And pretty well I'm thinking that the Britons essentially are Anglo-Mestizos from essentially Oklahoma. But anyway, I mean, that was one of the reasons he wanted to settle, because the supposedly the trial judge was supposed to be Edward Lodge, Sweaty Eddie Britton, not Sweaty Eddie Lodge here from the Cabot Lodges. And old Sweaty Eddie was the crooked judge who let, you know, Lon Herucci get away with a murder charge in state court here for shooting Vicki Weaver in the head. He said, no, federal sovereignty. I mean, federal goons can go ahead and shoot, you know, people in the head, you know, any damn time they want to. And so John Britton was freaking out, and Brian Reel at that time was essentially sending in, along with Cousin Ray, the lawyer Mariani, was sending in letter after letter after letter. And Brian Reel, he took down, you know, five of my web pages and blogs in November and December, including one which was supposed to be free speech in, you know, Kanuckistan. So essentially he went after Stumbleinn. I think you may have been around when he did that here. You know, Moz Monster came back, and essentially, and then Jaybird let him essentially ban me and, you know, delete all my posts that they could find over on the Manzer Barrel. And so he had a second attack in what, February and March of 2011, and around that, you know, so first Brian Reel took it down, and then Kane came down, you know, came and took it down too here. But Brian Reel was running wild in, you know, a second wave. And he got my, him and Cousin Ray and Eli James got my talk show show canceled, you know, in February. And pretty well what I did is I bought hosting in, about a week after I got kicked off of iWeb Kanuckistan. And since I bought secret hosting here, and had a friend of mine put back up my forum, and essentially only I knew where it was. You know what I mean? So essentially, I just go here and just keep on the posting here on my secret forum. So anyway, around that time, you know, 2011, he's just going on and on and on. He's telling Sweaty Eddie, oh, you know, John Britton's uncle, Newman, and all this sort of thing. He's Aryan Nations, he's this, he's that, he's violent, he threatened to shoot me in the head. You know, even though Brian Reel had essentially provoked Britton. You know, Britton's not able to keep his temper very well. Essentially, you know, Britton threatened to go ahead and shoot him in the head. You know, and I guess if he came to Emmett or something like that, but anyway, it goes on, and then Judge Sweaty Eddie makes a ruling on the motions in Lamine. He says, hey, this case has been going on for damn near 9 years, you know, for 8 or 9 years. Essentially, it's time to finally settle it. We're going to have this trial by jury 3 weeks from now, and essentially he ruled everything really that John Britton wanted. He essentially ruled that, guess what, the trial wouldn't be on John Britton being Aryan Nation or Christian Daddy or Newman Britton's nephew or any other search. It would be on whether or not a drunken machinist of a subsidiary of Rolls-Royce had machined out too much material on a critical engine part, i.e. the gas turbine nozzle. You know, there's this nozzle which essentially feeds this, I guess, fuel against the blades of a turbine, which is the one which powers the helicopter or something like that, and that whether or not that was the cause of the accident, and it was. And I said, John, Sweaty Eddie, he's a right bastard, but shit, he's giving you exactly what you want. He's going to take it to trial. He's essentially going to say the trial isn't going to be on all this other shit, which has nothing to do with the cause of the crash, but with the cause of the trash, which is what you wanted.
No, it's running off.
Oh, okay. And John Britton says, well, my great-great-great-great-great-grandfather was Matthew Britton, and he was a first mate aboard You know, Giovanni Combatos. You know, also known as John Cabot's 1497 voyage. You know, during the reign of King Henry VII, you know, to the New World, after King Henry VII had killed Richard III and all this good shit. So essentially, him and, you know, me and the Cabot, my family, Cabot Lodges, have been enemies forever. And I guess I didn't think to ask, if his ancestor was the Earl of Richmond, what was his other ancestor, what was his ancestor doing as a first mate, you know, underneath Giovanni Cabato? So essentially, he wanted to go ahead and cut a deal, and he said, he set himself $50,000. And what ended up happening is that because he decided to settle, his worthless scum-sucking lawyers decided to let Cousin Ray draft the settlement, and they drafted it so that if little Brian Real came back like he did with upstanding citizen and impersonated John Britton wouldn't lose only the $50,000 or the $110,000, which was what he was going to get, but the $330,000. And essentially, you know, I was up nights drafting shit to fire his lawyers, to get rid of them, to do this, do that. He was looking for a real lawyer. You know, I'm not a lawyer, you know, and I don't pretend to be, and I don't accept money, and I don't pull myself out. But as such, you know, I was just simply writing stuff up for him. And, you know, toward the end of February, essentially the magistrate judge, a different one, Aaron Sweaty Eddie, you know, he's a full judge, simply said, okay, $330,000 like you agreed, none of this Brian Real horse shit here. I mean, essentially, if there is any cause about the settlement here, it's going to be done by a jury trial. And essentially, what happens, though, is that he let the lawyers get $220,000. He got, you know, John Britton only got $110,000. Which was still twice $50,000. And I said, hey, John, we'll go ahead. Yeah, you go ahead. You pocket the money. And then about, you know, 4 months to a year later, we're going to, you know, we go ahead and we Title 42 the judge for essentially not giving you, you know, the split was supposed to be John Britton gets what? 2/3 and the lawyers get 1/3. But essentially they got 2/3. He only got 1/3. I said, so we'll go back after him here. And essentially, by the time the year went over here, he went for about 5 months. For 5 months afterwards, and I'd call him every so often. He stopped calling me. I'd call him, you know, or he'd call me every so often when he needed something. And essentially, I said, how much money you got left here? And it was, you know, well, $85,000, then it was $75,000, then it was $50,000, then it was $25,000, then it was $10,000, you know, around 4.5 months. And then 4.5 months, it was, none of it was left. He went through $110,000 in less than 5 months. And anyway, he started getting all huffy and says, you know, Brian Real cost him $110,000, and $100,000, and I'd cost him because I'd take Brian Real on him. And essentially, I sent out to a number of people, including this idiot Russ Walker, is that, hey, you know, John Britton ran through the money. He wants to blame me for it. And it's not my fault he ran through it. And he doesn't want to put down $350 and get the, go ahead and try to get the other $110,000 or however much else he's going to get. And, you know, like I told him, I said, shoot, you got $110,000. You blew it in less than 5 months. I mean, you're not going to get more than another $110,000 max. In fact, you're not going to even get that, and chances are you're not going to get anything. So if you run through that money, you're not going to get another payout probably in your life like that. Oh, I make that much in a year. Well, I don't know. I don't think so. But essentially, the entire time I've known him since 2005, he makes, you know, he'll make $60,000 on up, and essentially, you know, he won't have any of it left here. I remember when 2010, he went up to Alaska, and, oh, he should have made about $80,000 here, but they cheated him out about $10,000, and essentially we made them give, you know, because they weren't paying him for 1 day out of 7 like they promised. You know, and essentially, you know, they cheated him. And essentially, he got a check for $5,800, and then when it came time for the unemployment, I mean, here I was drafting appeals, you know, appeals and, you know, appeals of them not getting my employment. And I got him, you know, I got him 26 weeks in Washington, you know, state unemployment. And man, what happens is then we had to fight in Oregon from where this crooked company was at. And essentially I made this, you know, little crooked cocksucker judge, you know, back off twice here and essentially appealed his ruling, and essentially where John didn't have to pay back anything that he was going to get in Oregon. But, hey, I mean, it's just famine and feast with this guy. And, you know, essentially he gets the money, and he was mad as hell in 2011 when I says, okay, you know, of all that money you made in, what, four and a half months in Alaska, all you got to show that there's a $500 used Acer computer you bought at the Anchorage Walmart. That's all you got to show for 2010. And, oh, he was mad when I told him that. You know, but it's true. So, shoot. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm just sort of, you know. I mean, shoot, he just got into his head. Now he's running around with Jeremy Visser and, you know, all the other manager charged here. So, I don't know. He told you he had what? 3 sons and 6 daughters, huh?
Yeah, that's what I understood. I may have some of those emails on the bear barrel PMs. But I'd have to check. I think Zid deleted my account on StumbleIn, so I don't have the StumbleIn PMs anymore. But private messages, I might have them on Bear Barrel from between him and me. And so I don't know if that's true or not. But I definitely remember that.
I mean, that's confirmation with Cody. You know, he might have yet another wife and a daughter. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
But, heck, I pretty well think that the first woman, I mean, I was, you know, when essentially that guy showed it, I thought it was a Nimbuster retard here who was essentially pulling my dick. And I went ahead and said, I didn't pull my dick. You're a Cherokee, you made a son. You're jumping down there, son. And they went on here, and they said, oh, I'm a homosexual, too. I said, you're really pulling my dick. You're just a Nimbus. Because, oh, about 2 years ago, a Nimbuster, essentially named Kenwick Man, a.k.a. Casey, who's very good at impersonations here, especially George Takei, had me 90% convinced that it was actually the real George Takei, the gay japper, you know, on Star Trek. You know what I mean? Calling in. And... Oh, he did, you know, I mean, he sounded exactly like George Takei. You know what I mean? You know, Takei or Takai, the gay, you know, dapper. You know what
I
mean?
I remember the call when he was on, it's on YouTube still, I think.
I mean, the movement turn has had some Jerry Springer moments here, but the weird.
Yeah, well, somebody recorded it and put it on YouTube, I think, as well back.
Oh, the Nimbusters, you know, quite a few people did, you know what I mean? You know, the Obergender Bender and the Pisser Possums, you know, Obergender Bender and Jeremy Visser. Why, it wasn't just Nimbusters, everybody recorded, but here it was, and they were, I don't know, I mean, I thought I was being, you know, having my dick pulled, but essentially there's this other Christian identity adherent listening in, essentially, he noticed that, guess what, you know, guest number 34, who's John Britton's nephew, isn't denying it here. He's now talking about how Cody, you know, Cody isn't really a spam, he doesn't really work for a spam thing. He's actually an airline pilot. He goes on, essentially, he goes ahead and he tells about the $87,000 car that, all, you know, but, John bought Lorinda, and he says Lorinda don't know about it. I think Lorinda does know about John Britton running wild, and that's why she goes in and spends his money like that. You know, and he can't do a dang thing because she's blackmailing him. But anyway, 3 sons.
Well,
6 months.
I have to hand it to him.
I think if you would go ahead and see what you can find out here, and You know, if you get a chance, send it to pastorlinstead@gmail.com. And I'm glad we can go ahead and talk about this. I'm gonna go ahead and let you go here. But by the way, I'm recording this on my MP3 just in case it don't catch on TalkStew here. But,
I hit record on TalkStew, so it should be recorded this time. I sometimes forget to do that. Guest 5, call in. We have 1 minute. You can call in the next 60 seconds. I'm going to start my stopwatch. Pastor, appreciate you coming on, and I will.
Yeah.
It's Kane. You're done. Okay. Thanks.
Okay.
And I'll get in touch with you if I find anything on my Bear Bell account.
Macrobius said he was going to delete all the 2011 stuff here. So
I'll see what I can find. This is prior to 2011, but I'll let you know if I find anything. We're going to close up shop, so appreciate you coming on. Appreciate you on, Kane. Next week we're going to have a guest. I don't know who it is yet, but a surprise guest. So unless things go very wrong, as they sometimes and usually will, we will be back next week at 8 o'clock Central Time at American Onslaught Radio. And this is the voice of Gangster Bolshevik Broadcasting. This is Breckenridge Elkins signing off. 8:19 and long live death.
Bell victory. Pastor Lindstedt here.